Good morning. Again, my name is Bob. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bob.
12 Steps and 12 Traditions calls the 12th step the Joy of Living step. On page 89, starts what could conceivably could be considered a chapter on sponsorship. This chapter is like a blow by blow description of what to do, when to do it, what not to do. It tells you why you're going to do it. It's going to tell you even what the results and what's going to happen to you as a result of doing it. And I was encouraged. I fell into a group that did not have a big book consciousness. Matter of fact, in the 70s in Alcoholics Anonymous, there was very little big book consciousness in the world. And that sounds odd how a program could lose touch with its basic text, but that was pretty universal back in those days. And thank God for people like Jill McQueenie and Wesley Parrish and Franklin Williams, Don Pritz, who kept this thing alive in little pockets around the country. And eventually, through the efforts of Wesley Parrish, Joe McQueenie, and a guy named Charlie Parmby, they spread this consciousness of the big book. And now we're in a fellowship that's very, oddly enough, very big book oriented, almost to the point where we've sort of lost some of our fire for some of the other, for two of the other legacies at times. There's some groups in AA, they're so big book oriented, but they wouldn't take a meeting to a hospital, or they don't have any respect for singleness of purpose or the traditions. But the recovery legacy, I think, is once again alive and well in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is a very good thing. We do have three legacies here, and I try to sponsor people in all three and encourage them to participate and be active in the principles that are encompassed in all three legacies. In the beginning of this chapter, it says, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works where other activities fail. I believe from my experience that you can stay sober on step 1 and step 12 for possibly a lifetime. Possibly. I don't know that it would be a fun lifetime, but it would be a sober lifetime. And it would be a lifetime of intermittent joy and freedom mixed with periods of, I would imagine, if you're like me, depression and anxiety. It's not freedom, but it is relief. And I eventually, if you're like me, after years of staying sober on relief, there's a part of me that just needs more. I need freedom. Freedom from what? Well, from the bondage of self. And the relief from the bondage of self and the freedom from the bondage of self are two different animals, even though the symptoms of the relief and the symptoms of the freedom are very similar. One is intermittent and one has a little more substance to it. And I got that from the practicing of all the 12 steps and actually all three legacies. But it's the 12-step work saved my life. I was encouraged from day one out of the hospital to start taking meetings back into the detox I just got out of. I was encouraged I'm talking at just several weeks of sobriety, putting my name on the 12-step list. At less than 2 months sober, they had me sign up to go into a new meeting that had just started in the state penitentiary. They didn't have the standards back in those days. You couldn't even do that today. Today you have to have so many years of sobriety and go through a class. Not in those days. They say, here's the people we're bringing, and they go, okay, and they put you on the cleared list, and you came. I remember the first time I, my God, I'm only a couple months sober. First time I went to a meeting in the state prison, and they told me I was going to speak, and I'm, oh my God, I'm not really an ex-convict. I did county time. But convicts, real criminal convicts, are just kind of a little, whoa. I got in there, I was nervous, and they're all looking at me, and they're all tatted up, and I told them, I said, you know, I didn't have enough time, I wanted to get a bunch of tattoos on the way to the meeting. Maybe if I could stop and punch a cop or something, you guys would like me better. I don't, you know, and they laughed. They thought that was funny. They thought it was great. But it was genuine. And it was genuine, and you've always encouraged me to be genuine, not to be perfect. That I would help more people from the reality of my experience than from ideals. And I didn't know why I was doing all this. I remember when this guy told me to get on the 12-step list and start going on 12-step calls. I wouldn't argue with people in AA. I would do what they said, but I would always want to explain to them how they might possibly be wrong. And I told this guy, I said, well, you know, don't you think I should, I mean, I guess I felt I was really messed up. Don't you think I should work on me first? And the guy said to me, you've done quite enough of that. Stop it. Just go do this. Go on the list and go to the meetings in the institution and do that stuff. And I started doing it, and I didn't know what I'm doing it for. And I am an alcoholic very much like Bill Wilson. I'm an alcoholic who's depressive by nature. It's really self-pity. And it's the self-pity of and the depression-like symptoms of a guy who just is very, at times, self-involved. I just get myself right on myself until it seems to smother my very being. I just overwhelmed like that. I tell you the experience I had in early sobriety. This will really quantify the whole thing. I remember going to a meeting at night, one night, and I had had a very good day. And I was not depressed about anything. I was really feeling very cool. I had a great day at work. I got off work. I met a bunch of guys at Denny's. We had something to eat. We laughed and kidded around. I'm on my way to a meeting. Things are very cool this day. Now, not all my days were great, but this was a good day. And I'm walking into this meeting, and this guy, Wade Bergen, Wade, who passed away a few years ago, Wade's standing at the door, he's kind of a greeter, and Wade shakes my hand, looks me right in the eye with one of those deep look in your eye looks. And he says to me, Bob, how you doing? How you really doing? And I said, fine. And I went and I sat in the meeting, and I thought, geez, what's he know? I said, oh my God, I think about it, I don't even really feel very good. I started looking around in the meeting, and everybody all of a sudden seemed happier than I was. And I just started realizing I've been in denial. My life's crap. I just started sinking into this abyss. And what had changed? Nothing. Except I went from being in reality and right out here, right in my life and present, to self-obsessed, self-focused, self-involved. And I'm one of those, I have never in my life sat for any period of time and pondered myself and came away joyous. Some people may have that kind of mindset where they just want to go think and get happy. I don't think myself happy. I've never thought myself happy. I think myself miserable. To me, my mind automatically sees the glass as half empty and it'll never be full. Other people maybe have a mental line that goes, the glass is half full, isn't that wonderful? Mine's half empty. And that's my nature. Don't make me a bad guy, it's just my nature. And so I didn't understand that what was happening to me in my early sobriety, that these guys would throw me into this 12-step work, and intermittently in a life with a tendency to overwhelming anxiety and worry and fear and self-pity and depression, that I'd have these islands of relief that were very much similar to my experience on the streets, where I'm kind of a mope and I feel awful and terrible, and then I get high and it'd be a little island of relief for me, and then I'd get back into hungover and sick and awful and things are depressing and terrible, and then I get high and it was a little better until I wore it out, until the end, the last couple of years, there was not even any relief in the bag and the bottle for me anymore. And that's really what brought me to AA. And so in AA, I'm doing all this, but I don't get that it's helping because it doesn't help once and for all. I don't know why I would expect the actions of AA to be once and for all remedy. Because I never expected that in alcohol. I never bought a bottle of whiskey and drank it and then was disappointed the next day because I was still not high. You always know you got to get another one the next day. And because it's a chronic condition, and this is the medicine for a chronic condition. It's not an acute condition that the medicine treats once and for all like pneumonia. It's a chronic condition like diabetes. Yesterday's treatment of diabetes for the diabetic has really very little to do with today's diabetes. Today's got new blood sugar problems. Today's the day you got to do the insulin. Yeah, sure, you did it yesterday. You got to do it again today. And alcoholism's very much like that. And they didn't understand what was happening, but I would get this freedom. I remember one night, a Paramount night, I was sober a little while, and I'd been doing all this 12-step work and seeming like it wasn't working because I didn't realize it was. And I'd spent a whole night... I'd spent the earlier part of the night in a deep depression, somehow got myself to a meeting and ended up hooking up with a guy, and there was no one else around to help him, and I spent the whole night until the sun starting to come up in a waiting room in an emergency room with this guy trying to get him a bed in the county hospital because I was afraid he was going to go into seizures. And in that time I spent with him, something happened to me that had already been changing my life, but I didn't know it, and then I woke to what was the reality of what was going on. And what basically happened is this guy started to, he was in such pain and such hopelessness, he started to tell me about himself, and everything he told me about him had been oh so true in me. His inability to drink successfully anymore and how miserable he was when he drank and yet he couldn't stay sober, and all the remorse and shame that he'd felt for the things he did to the people who loved him and how he couldn't drink it away anymore, and his thoughts of and desire to commit suicide for some time and his inability to have the courage to do it and how he loathed himself and hated himself for being such a coward, and how he didn't know why a guy like me or anybody in AA would even bother with him anymore because he's not like the people in AA, he always drinks again. And that's exactly the guy I brought to you. That's exactly. And I something happened to me in the middle of the evening, in the middle of the night, early morning actually, where I just fell in love with this guy. I remember sitting there in the waiting room and was overcome with this feeling in here that was so amazing. I really, really and truly wanted this guy more than anything to be okay. I wanted him to be okay more than I wanted me to be okay. I was more concerned with him than I was with me. And I was free. I was free. I was the guy earlier that evening that was in the deep depression. I was free. And the freedom came from loving him and being concerned with him. And for no self-aggrandizement, this guy can't do anything for me. Self has no vested interest in helping him. He's not going to get me a better job. He's not even going to, he's a chronic relapser. He's probably not even going to stay sober a year and give me any kind of credit for anything. But he was exactly like me. And it was quite a while later that I realized that I had fallen in love with the me that was in him. And that has to happen here. If you want to be free, really inside, and you want to be okay with yourself, you cannot love yourself directly. There are therapists that try to get... I had a therapist who kept hammering me to love yourself. I hear people in meetings say that all the time. I can't help anybody else yet because I need to learn to love myself. Oh, give them a towel. God, what a narcissistic approach. It doesn't work for a guy like me. I was given positive affirmations. I was supposed to stand in front of a mirror and look myself in the eye and say over and over again, God loves me, God forgives me, God accepts me, I love me, I forgive me, I accept me. Bullshit. I mean, I could have stood there and said that till the planet blew up and it wouldn't have changed how I felt about myself. I cannot love myself directly. And not from a lack of trying. I mean, I don't think I'm any different. I mean, has anybody on the planet ever been concerned with anything more consistently and obsessively than you've been concerned with yourself? I mean, can you imagine worrying about anything as much as you've worried about yourself? And even when you worry about your loved ones and your business and everything, it's really an extension of you because it's your family and your business and your... It's all me, 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 me. So if trying to do for me or loving me or helping me or anything to do with me could have made me better, it would have years ago. But when I started to care about objectively and legitimately you and love the me that is in you, it healed the me that is in me. And it's a funny approach. I couldn't approach it head on. It never worked for me. I had to love me through loving you. And I think that also opened a door and brought the presence of God more distinctly into my life. As I went home that evening, that morning actually, I went home, I could feel the presence of God in my life. And it was exactly what Bill Wilson talks about in his story. It wasn't through prayer meditation. It was through self-sacrifice and working with others and thoughts of others. It was because I was trying to help and care about this guy that moved me, which is the blockage, over and out and let the light come in. And I knew that morning that I remember driving home and feeling this amazing feeling. This tremendous sense of wonder, lightness, and just like, and rightness. Everything was just perfect. My life was perfect at that moment. And thinking to myself, I want to feel this way the rest of my life. You know, when it says in here that nothing will help us like this, I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I would have died of alcoholism many, many years ago. And on many, many occasions, if it wouldn't have been for 12-step work, if it wouldn't have been for the guys I sponsor, my commitments in institutions and hospitals that have literally saved me from me. And you don't know that when you're taking these commitments and you're saying yes to sponsoring these people and you're giving them your phone number, if you're like me, you don't understand that you're building a weapon that one day will save your life from the only enemy you've ever had, which is you. I'll tell you a little story. I was a little over 10 years sober. I went through a very, very, very painful divorce. Tough. I was married. I had a daughter at the time. She was about 2 years old. Just about 2 years old. And who I just loved. I've never loved anything like I've loved my daughter. I was the first human being to ever hold her and give her a bath. And I was in the delivery room. And it was amazing. She just stole my heart and has it to this day. And when I went through this divorce, I was so distraught, because what had happened is the day after the divorce was final, my wife and daughter moved in with one of my sponsees. And my favorite sponsee, the guy who'd been primarily the confidant in my marriage problems. And I discovered that they had been sleeping together the whole last year of my marriage, and everybody knew about it except me. So I am insane. I am being eaten alive from the inside by this tapeworm of a resentment that's eaten my heart. And I'm nuts. And I'm in a dangerous, dangerous spot. But I'm very entrenched in service, and I'm very entrenched in sponsoring guys. And one Sunday, I think it was a Sunday or Saturday, one weekend I had it all set up to go over and spend the whole day with Kate. And she's a little over 2 years old, I guess, at the time. She's the sweetest, cutest little girl you've ever seen. And I have to drive up to the place where they're all living together in order to pick her up. And I got this anxiety about seeing them together and seeing them. And I trying to be a good guy. And I drive up with this knot in the pit of my stomach. And I get out of the car and I go up to the door and I knock on the door. And the frickin' happy couple answers the door. And they say, "Oh, we'll go get Kate." And they bring Kate out. And I take Kate by the hand, and we go out and get my car, and we go off to spend the day together. And one of the things I had set up was to take her to this ranch that a friend of mine worked at, that had sheep and goats and cows and bunny rabbits and ducks, and they had all kinds of animals, and horses and ponies. And Kate was very, very excited about ponies. And she was going to get a chance to ride ponies. And we were going to set her in the corral on the ponies and take her around. And she was very, very jazzed about ponies. And we spend the whole day, and she's just ridden the ponies. And we're sitting on this picnic table right outside the corral. And she's thirsty. Well, we're sitting there, and it's the gal who works there that I know from AA, and then my daughter and myself. And I said, "I'll be right back. I'm going to go get some soda." And there's a soda machine across the yard next to the stable. So I left them there, and I went and I got a couple cans of soda. And I'm coming back across the yard, and I hear Kate, I hear the woman that works there say to my daughter, "Hey, Kate, here comes your daddy." And Kate looks up and looks at me, looks at the woman and says, "That's not my daddy. Craig's my daddy." And I tell you something, it felt like somebody stuck a knife in me and just twisted it. And I pushed those feelings down, and I went back to sat down at that picnic table and gave my daughter the soda. And we sat there and spent the rest of the day together. And that night, I got to take her home. And I drive up to the place where they're all living together. And I take her by the hand, and I walk her up to the door and knock on the door. And the happy couple answers the door. And Kate jumps into his arms, and I turn around and walk all by myself back to my car. I get in the car, I drive about a block or so away, and I pull over to the side, and I just come apart at the seams. And I'm sitting in the car, and I'm crying and talking to God at the same time. And I'm saying to God, I love my daughter, but I can't do this. This hurts too much. And I am prepared and convicted that I am going to have to stop seeing my daughter. I can't do this. And I look at the clock on the dashboard, and I'm going to be late. I'm supposed to meet this knucklehead newcomer down at one of the SOS club in Vegas, one of the AA clubs, and he's waiting down there for me. I got to pick him up, and I promised him I'd take him across town to this meeting he'd never been to, and I don't want to go. I need to go home and think. But you guys have convinced me. The first principle in AA is kid, and this has been hammered into me. Thank God. Mm-hmm.
You do what you say you're going to do. Can you show up where you get pushed? You don't care how you feel. You show up where you said you're going to show up. Ah, crap. And I hurry across town and I get the guy, the idiot's pacing up and back and forth in front of the SOS. I pull up, get in the car. Driving away, going across town to this other meeting. And I tell you, he's not even in the car 5 minutes, not even 2 minutes. And he starts telling me about how he'd been denied by the courts to ever see his kids. And he's telling me with tears in his eyes. And I'm hearing him. I'm hearing him. And it was like a postcard from God. Dear Bob, there's only one person that can ever interfere with you seeing your daughter, Bob, and it's you. I remember listening to him and looking at him crying about never seeing his kids and thinking to myself, I'll see her again next week. I can do this 1 week at a time. And it's been, my daughter's 22 years old. I'm helping her to buy, she just bought her first house. And I was able to give her the down payment for it. She wants to pay me back, and I told her, please, don't pay me back. I'm just delighted to do this. And she is the one, the light in my life. I mean, he has been and gone. Several relationships through there. He just went through another divorce from another gal, and he's been and gone. And she is my daughter, and I'm her dad. And I almost threw that all away. That new guy that I picked up, he thought I was helping him. Oh my God. He saved the most precious thing in my life. God worked through him. And I'll tell you something, I don't want to sound self-righteous here, but this is my experience. If you don't put yourself out there to help people and be willing to sponsor and things like that, I tell you, I think you're tying God's hands. Because He will work through those people. The illusion is you're helping them. It's not really that way. You will get more help from them than you will ever give to them. They'll save your life. They'll save your sanity. They'll relieve you of the bondage of self. They'll bring you to a level of accountability, spiritual accountability that's beyond anything your sponsor can give you. I can't tell you how many things that have brought, how many things that I've come to the table with in step six. And became entirely ready to have God removed. Not because of anything going on in me, other than I realized that I'm being a bad example to this guy that I sponsor. I'll tell you, I think one of the most powerful things that we have going for us is that we love, we have the potential to love each other much more than we could ever love ourselves. I have done things in Alcoholics Anonymous for the love of you that if it would have just been about me, I would have done that. I don't care enough. You don't think that's true. How quick would you be to go out of your way if one of your very close friends in AA was sick and needed to go to the doctor and didn't want to go? How quick would you be to try to go pick them up and get them to go? And how resistant are you to get yourself to go when you really should? It really is. You kind of compete how you really. Actually, I really love these people probably, objectively, probably more than I love myself. How often you do anything to get one of your best friends to help them quit smoking, but you wouldn't do it for yourself? Mm-hmm. Right? I think that sometimes that's the love of a drunk for a drunk is the most important thing we got here. It saves us from ourselves. Don't miss this opportunity. You will see the hand of God very distinctly in helping others. You'll see it much clearer than you will ever see it in your own life. I don't know. I'm self-centered. God can do all kinds of miracle things for me, wonderful things. Then the shine wears off him and says, well, what have you done for me lately? You know, I'm that kind of guy. I don't mean to be, but emotionally, that's my interaction. I come from that place. And I take crap for granted very quickly. I don't see hand of God in my life that clearly, but I see it through years. I've spent over 31 years trying to be awake to the presence of God in my life, and over 31 years trying to be awake to the presence of self and its manifestations. That is what we do. We continue to watch for the manifestations of self. It's a part of the package of step 10 and 11. And to be awake enough to be grateful for the gifts I'm being given in the hand of God in my life and the hand of God in your life. But you know something? I have never seen God eyeball to eyeball. I've seen His presence. I've felt His presence. I've seen the results of Him in my life. But I've never actually seen Him eyeball to eyeball. I can go out into a beautiful day and see His presence and all kinds of stuff, His hand. And I have never seen my ego eyeball to eyeball, but I see its manifestations every single day of my life. And I think over the years, I have developed an ongoing, increasing sense of myself. And the ego and the self-centeredness, and also an ongoing and increasing awareness of God. You can really get a sense of a creator by the creator's creation. There are musicians that I've listened to every song they've ever written and sang. I've never met them, but I feel like I know them. There are authors where I've never met them, but I've read every book they've ever written. And I think I could run into somebody to introduce me to them. I could go into an hour-long conversation with them like I knew them forever. And I've never met them. But I am very familiar with their manifestations and their creation. And I think that's what we do with God and we do with the enemy, which isn't really the enemy. I say that sometimes. But self is a God-given thing. You know, we have a tendency to bad rap the things that cause us difficulty. But without self, I would never struggle and develop such integrity as I have to struggle towards the light if I didn't have something pulling me away from it. It is the great tug of war between ego and God, or ego and spirit. And I gravitate. I think we are divinely made that the one feels so bad and the other feels so good. And you don't know that for a while because the other one initially feels good. And then you wear that out and then you have to go somewhere else. And I think the ego serves its purpose. It is a God-given thing. It's not bad. But like it says in the 12 steps and 12 traditions, we take these things to an extreme. Absurd extremes, perhaps, but we take them to extremes. See, I am alcoholic in every area of my life. I drink of ego gratification the same way I drink of whiskey. I am not a social ego gratifier. I don't just have one and go home. Right? I didn't take it to the wall, and that's my natural inclination. I was thinking it was about 10 years ago. I was sitting one day and I was thinking to myself, I was trying to remember if there was ever a time in my life of any duration. Like not more than a flash in the pan, more than just a day. Any time in my life of any duration where I was absolutely and completely satisfied with things as is. And I've never had that.
There's never been in the time of my life, drunk or sober, where, especially sober, where I've ever thought that I was free enough from self, where I ever thought I was close enough to God, wherever I thought I was useful enough or helpful enough or did a good enough AA member or a good enough sponsor. I've always yearned for more. Phil Wilson, in coming out the backside of his depressions, because he disconnected himself from the thing that kept him free, as when he moved to Bedford Hills, and he was no longer in the trenches every single day down at Towns Hospital and Calvary Mission. He became a figurehead concerned with an extension of himself, which AA had become. And he became very, very depressed. And he got through that and he got back to the basics. And was having a conversation with Father Ed Dowling, who Father Ed Dowling brought him back to the thing he had, that God brought through him that could have saved his life, and he could have abandoned it and got out with all this other crazy stuff. And Ed said, Bill said, Bill's doing pretty good again. And Bill says to Ed one day, he says, I'm doing all right, but I'm free from the depression for the most part now, and I feel like I'm over that part of that deal, and I feel pretty good, but it's not enough. He said, I don't feel like I'm close enough to God. I don't feel like I'm free enough of self. I don't feel like I've grown enough spiritually or I've done enough good or helped enough people, and on and on and on and on. And Father Ed Dowling started laughing. And Father Ed said to him, Bill, you have what us in the clergy believe is God's greatest blessing. We refer to it as divine dissatisfaction. It's the thing in you that drives you, pushes you, or shoves you towards the light. It's what keeps me striving along spiritual lines. I am that kind of person. I have divine dissatisfaction. I think that you hear something is bleeded in here out of the psychology community and treatment, where it's almost as if we bad rap our own sense of not enoughness, our own inadequacy and our own incompleteness, as if that's a bad thing. Matter of fact, I've been in meetings where people would talk about how they got over that. I feel sad for them. It is the most blessed thing I have. It keeps me growing along spiritual lines. We don't arrive. I feel sorry for the people that arrive, because where they've rove to is a place where there is no more growth. I strive, and I struggle, and there's a rightness about that. I think it is the hand I'm dealt, and I cherish these things that at one time I used to want to be free from. See, I don't know. I can't manage my own life. If given a choice, if I had the choice, I would have discarded everything that has been good for me and would have brought to me everything that would have been bad for me. I would have medicated the emotions that were moving me to be more than what I was and bring me closer to God and push me into growing along spiritual lines. And I would have embraced all the things that felt good, which have never done me much good. That's why I can't manage my own life. I will always feed the wrong dog. Not because I'm a bad guy. That's my nature. Okay.
Well, Bob, you ate up a lot of my time.
Oh, I did. I am sorry.
Yes, you did. Mm-hmm. Well, so I said, oh, they're going... Well, I have 7 minutes left.
You can go to...
No, I know that, don't you? Now, had you been Charlie? Oh, I would have been passing your notes.
Would have been a dry spell.
That's right. Absolutely. See, just because I'm a woman, I am still a drunk. Yes? Does not change anything. Although they do have a special term for women that are... I guess it's bitchy, but I say drunk to drunk. First of all, it's been quite an honor. Quite an honor. You know, Bob is, oh, just love Bob. Love Bob. And I am very honored to be here. I hope I have, I know, as I said, I'm qualified for this seat. I hope you feel the same way. And if you don't, talk to your sponsor, please. Not to me. We jokingly say that, but the truth is that, you know, we sit ourselves up here and we're incredibly vulnerable. Oh my gosh, I'm no spiritual giant. I'm as easy to lose my mind on any given day. But today, my life is better than it's ever been, hands down. I'm 25 years sober. I'm telling you, I had no idea the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous would bring me to where I am today. I lost my husband at 20 years. You know, this is a man that divorce was not an option, period. Not in our conversation. And I'm happily married to Charlie Parker, which I think we have the entire community shocked that the two of us didn't kill each other. And I can't even begin to tell you that this step, after we're unblocked, after all of this process we talked about happens, this step is the one that has absolutely changed my life. And I got to tell you, I know there's several of y'all sitting out there that don't sponsor. And I feel like there's a gift sitting at your feet, and you just don't ever open it. You kick it around all your life, kick it around, it gets all tattered, and you never open that gift. And that's the gift that God wants to take you. We were drinking, we were living in the ghetto. We move outside of the ghetto, we live on the outskirts. Right? We're just on the outskirts. And God says, oh my gosh, I got a mansion over here for you to live in. And we don't do it because I think a lot of reasons. I think you're scared. I think you're scared, period. Once again, fear will rob you. We classify it with stealing. It will rob you of some of the greatest gifts. And the best way to sponsor is ask your sponsor. Tell me what to do. Tell me what to do. I mean, you're constantly on the phone. All of my sponsees' problems are their sponsees. Rarely are they calling me going, you know, my husband said this or my father's upset with me. It's like, okay, I got this sponsee that this is happening. I need you to tell me what I need. It's unbelievable. And it's an incredible gift. And I'm telling you, this weekend is what it's about. Now, don't wait till you know, a lot of people, we just wait. Until, like, all of a sudden one day we wake up. Don't you? It cracks me up when I hear people say, well, they told me to make no major changes for 1 year. So I'm not to get in a relationship for 1 year. And on day 366, I am so horny. You know what I mean? And you just want to go, what? You know, none of it makes sense. And it's just what somebody, once again, one person said, don't get in a relationship for 1 year. And we are such, what would you call that when I just, whatever's on you, I just take it. And I just hold it and say, this is what they told me. This is what I have. It just doesn't compute to me. Book clearly tells me, I cannot be the arbiter of your sex life. That pretty much tells me, I can't tell you when you can and can't have sex, can I? So, now granted, I can talk about it if it's troublesome. But the truth of the matter is if you read the book, it tells you to begin working with others immediately. Because it says, you know, some people are confused. Once again, I share with you all my confusions, and I want to clear them up. I believe God's asked me to be a teacher, so that's the best way for me to teach. Is when I heard in meetings you had to have 1 year of sobriety before you could become a sponsor, that is the group conscience decision. I honor and respect the group conscious decision. I personally think it's a stupid one, but I honor it. Right? I'm an alcoholic. I've got plenty of opinion and judgment that goes on up here that you never hear. But I honor that. So it says, who's prepared to sponsor? Well, I can't stand up unless I have a year, because the group conscious is the highest authority of the group. So I must honor that. But if I'm standing at the coffee machine and I see the new guy, I damn sure can grab him and sponsor him. Right? Are you understanding how that concept works? But I'm respecting the group conscious decision that I'm not going to stand up if I've got 6 months and say I can sponsor and go against them. Okay, so one of the other things that Mark used to say is, how do you know what you don't know? I never got that line for a long, long time. I thought, huh? What do you think? How do you know what you don't know? I don't know. And wow, do I get that. And once again, contempt prior to investigation is how I live. I came out of the womb judging you, judging authority, judging everything. It didn't fit up here, out. And so, one of the things, and Bob pointed this out to me, and it was one of my favorite. If practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intense work with others. Intense. Doesn't say one sponsee, does it? Intense work with others. It says it works whenever their activities fail. Prayer and meditation. Talking to my sponsor. Not that those are bad. But I must do that. Because it's about getting out of self. And page 14 is once again one of my favorite pages here where it says, I'm sorry, page 24, where it says, second line from the bottom. Wrong page. Page 14. Where it says, second line from the bottom, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. I love when there's exclamation points. A lot of people say, you know, the squiggly lines. Absolutely. But those exclamation points get my attention. For if an alcoholic fail to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, then there's a comma. Tells you right there. It's not all about the 11th step. Is that a powerful and important step? Absolutely. But we're talking about your growth spiritually comes when you work with others on a level you will never, never even see. It's like what Bob said. I mean, just, you can't even put it into words. It's so moving. He could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. And I'm going to try really hard not to keep talking about Mark, but I got to tell you, that weekend, Charlie and I have rocked the AA community in Austin. We have started a big book study, 175 people a week come here. We have tried 5 treatment centers coming. That's how much we believe in getting that new guy into the literature. We met Bob. We bring Bob and Scott and Bob and Ralph and Bob and Chris S., to Austin, and we have 250 people studying the big book. I have a meeting at my house, or that line, I'm telling you, you piss me off, and I will go to the highest mountain to prove you wrong. I still got all that in me. Am I talking to the right group of people? And you tell me there's not enough strong women in AA? Kiss my ass. Watch. I'll get you some strong women in AA. You know, and Mark Houston was the other person who said that to me. He said, you know what, Katie, when I said that to you, I also knew that you're the kind of gal who will line up 100 women and go, now, tell me there's no strong women in AA. And he said, look what you're doing. I have a meeting at my house one Monday a month where I'm teaching 50 women how to sponsor. I'm teaching them how to sponsor. This is not open for you to sit around and tell me what was taught to you and how you did it. It says over here, it says that we have to stand on the firing line. We are his agents. Now I tell them, you want to leave out of here and tweak this and just go do whatever you want. This is how it was taught to me. This is where I have success. This is where I was brought out of the book. Because what was taught to me earlier, yeah, I stayed sober. I'm not knocking it. But I darn sure I'm not going to teach somebody what was taught to me. It was very, very poor. It was very poor. And they did the best they could. It's not about knocking. That is just about, this is my experience. And so these women, they come to the house, the first meeting, and this is when God's involved. Step out of the way, man. Because I don't know who we're going to touch here. Mark said, when there was 50 people, he said, look. And when he got passionate, he's from the Don Pritz and that group, he goes, look what happened. Look at you and Charlotte. Look what happened. Who would have guessed that, you know? We just came and I swear, I just wanted to shut up. I'm sitting in the audience going, shut up. Who would have guessed that what God had for us, you know, who would have guessed that after Joe died and this life that was, what I thought was really okay, would have been taken in a new life, better than I could have ever expected. It says, God says, and here it says, when we look back and we see what God has done, better than anything I could have ever expected. If He had me write out everything I believe was the greatest gift, never in my wildest dreams. The fact that we are he likes to say his favorite couple. Dear friends, this relationship would have never happened, because I tell you what, if I'm going to Vegas, I damn sure am not going to AA. 8 years ago, absolutely not. I'm going to Vegas to have some fun. I'm not going to drink, but I'm going to have some fun. I'm not going to meet Bob Darrell, go to his house to a big book study. Not even on my radar. See what I'm saying? Because I was running the show. Just, it's unbelievable. And so it says on page 103, I wrote several pages down here to get this. It says down about two paragraphs up from the bottom. Your job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum usefulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. Your job, when you help another alcoholic, that is the part, the paradox. When you love your brother, you love yourself. That's how it works. You can say all the affirmation. I did the same thing Bob did. I had the sticky notes all over the house. It was almost embarrassing. Look in the mirror and say, you love yourself, you love yourself. That works for some people, but not drunks. We're different. We gotta help another drunk, and that's when, whew, man, can I sleep at night. And bottom of page 103, after all, our problems were of our own making. Oh, there he goes again. Bottles were only a symbol. Besides, we have stopped fighting anybody or anything. We have to. Now, the other part was Dr. Bob. And I may have this wrong, Bob. You may have to correct me. But didn't Bob always say that he never really liked working with the drunk? I mean, he loved working with the drunk, but he had to work hard at being that guy to work with the drunk. Or am I completely misunderstanding something?
I don't know.
Well, basically, maybe this was in the beginning. Well, you know what? I'm not going to even touch that, because I could be so wrong. And God knows we'll take that. And in 4 years, that'll be so distorted. So, erase anything I just said from your memory.
Dr. Bob hated alcohol.
Absolutely. And Katie said it. It's on tape. Oh, my God. I've been around long enough to know to go, retract. Delete. Erase. Okay. So, page 181. Dr. Bob loved working with drunks. It says, number one, what? It was a sense of duty. Doesn't that sound like you're on the firing lines, going to war? Absolutely. It was a sense of duty. It was a pleasure. Because in doing so, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. Because every time I do it, I take out a little bit more insurance for myself against a possible slip. That sounds a little bit better than, well, I stayed sober, didn't I? Oh, I hate when I hear that in AA. Well, I mean, I go out to talk to the drunks, and I mean, I don't really care if they stay sober, but I did. I'm like, oh man, you're bugging me. We're going to have to step outside and probably have a little chat about that. Does that not sound self-centered as hell? But at least I stayed sober. And I'm like, does that sound like any of those four things that Bob just said? I'm just taking out a little bit of insurance. I don't help the drunk so that I stay sober. I help the drunk because my life has improved 1,000%. Not even 100. That's why I do it. I sat down with that guy from Norway. Oh, I did not want to do that. I absolutely did not want to do that. On Thursday before I was leaving for Canada. Charlie was already gone. He was down at the PGA show. I wanted that day to pack. and get my world together. Go to the gym, dot my I's, go see my grandson. And when he was sitting in front of me, I said, let me make it real clear to you. I'm already pissed off at you anyway. I'm doing this because I committed to God. And he knew clearly. I wasn't fooling that, you know, I'm such a self-sacrifice, even when trying to be kind, you know. And by the time we were done, I was very, very grateful for him. You know what I'm saying? But if you think I'm going to get to that place to where I'm at, that mushy, you know, that I'm not mad already, and then let me get, you know, work through this deal, that just doesn't work that way to me. And so it says, what's another thing? I mean, how many people do you hear go, well, you know, we don't have meetings like this, and we don't have strong this, and we don't have this. And I look at them and go, well, let's start it. What do you think? Don't sit there and bitch. Start it. Get the damn thing going in your area. Get a big book study going at your house. You don't have to find a place. Get a big book study. Start telling people. You don't have people who's strong women or men. You know, it was funny. I told Charlie, you know, they sit around. Oh, I'm not letting this one go. They sit around. I have all my sponsors. The reason I can sponsor so many people, or at least I like to think so, is because I have them all meet at my house one night a week, right? We're all on the same page, yada, yada, yada. I have a system. When you get in my arena, this is how I do it. I'm not meeting you at every meeting. I'm not having coffee with you every chance I get. I'm not, you know, getting your 30-day chip, your 60-day chip, your 90-day chip. I'm not doing that. I'm getting you in touch with a power that can save your life. That's my job. It's not my job to be your best friend. You can find a fellowship around you. And Charlie has a bunch of boys, all the boys he sponsors, they meet, and Mark was a big part of that Thursday nights, and my girls were on Monday nights. And so I told Charlie, I said, oh, okay, well, this whole big, there's not enough strong women in AA. I said, of the women at my table, what would you say? 6, 7 of them, solid in this program. 5, 6 of them, not so solid. I said, tell me about your boys sitting at your table. Were every one of them solid? And he goes, well, that's funny you would mention that. What do you know that you don't know? He said, no, that's not true. Half of them, less than half of them, are solid. The other ones I'd be scared to send a drunk to. But the point's made. Okay.
We really don't have enough strong women in.
And then when there's a big book study, you have to request a woman. For that to go on note. Oh, no, sir. You are way down there, Mr. Man. Okay. So, I want to end with a couple of things here. And that is, Bob did such a fabulous job about talking about working with the drunk. I want to tell you, this is how you get the guy that's hurting. You go into your AA meeting, and you know we laugh in AA all the time, tons of laughter in AA. I want you to look around the room for the guy that's not laughing. Wow, will you be shocked at how many people are not laughing? There's people in here that are not laughing when we're all laughing. I know who you are. I've paid attention. Because that's what I ask God. I said, show me who I can help in that meeting. See, we get in our cliques in AA. We can't wait to see our friends and get our needs met when that fellowship is designed for us to go help the person that's hurting, right? We can all go meet for coffee afterwards. I mean, I love every time you see Bob at one of these events, he's always got his sponsees meeting him. He's got a buddy that I know that he sponsors out of Austin. Knew he was going to be in Houston. Bob's like, drive on down, see me, we'll do step work. So not only is he sitting in here doing this deal, he's doing step work with this guy. Now, some people go, well, I'm not willing to do that much AA. Fine. Your life is your life. What do you know that you don't know? You don't have a clue what you're missing here. And so you find the guy that's not laughing. You go over there. Now, you got to ask God to speak through you because you'll become all preachy. Thank you. I've already learned it the hard way. And then I'm going to end with this one last story. Oh, and then the other thing I like to do, especially the new guy. You go up to the new guy and you go, hey, are you new? Yeah, I am. And so how long have you been coming? Oh, this is my third meeting. And so you say, have you got a sponsor? And they go, no. Go, well, then I'll be your sponsor. And come on outside. Let's talk about the doctor's opinion. Because that's how they did it when we got sober. There was no waiting till you related to somebody. Hell, the new guy doesn't even know where the bathroom is. We want him to pick out somebody to connect him to a higher power. I think we ought to go ahead and probably take the rein, you know, the horse by the rein. And so, and then you just start working with the guy. They know no different. It's not about you give them their phone number. You take their phone number. That's our duty. Our duty. And so, my sponsor works for a judge in Austin, and he's real big about alcoholism. Of course, he thinks everybody's got it. And so when he sees somebody making a bad decision, that they're willing to go to prison and not take treatment, he likes to call on us. And so he asked Marty, and we believe women with women, men with men. I'm pretty solid in that. I know there's exceptions to the rule, but that's, I'm a woman, and let me tell you, we're crafty. We'll catch you when you're not looking, and voila! And we mean no harm, but that's what our DNA is about. So, he calls me and he says, there's a girl that is, and my sponsor calls me and says, my judge wants you to come talk to this girl. And she's signing away her rights and she's going to prison for 2 years. She's not taking treatment. Safe P, it's another program. And he wants you to talk to her. And I was very honored. So I bring my sponsee with me. She's all tatted up because this girl's she's pretty much a gang girl. And, you know, here I come in. It's kind of, all she's going to do is see me not as a gang. You know, she didn't see me 25 years ago. And so we sit in this little glass thing and the little microphone. And I never did jail time. I'd like to think I was smarter than y'all, but I know that doesn't get a lot of laughs, does it? But it's true. And so my old sponsee and I were walking in, and she goes, I said, how do you want to do this? And she goes, I want you to start. And I said, okay. And I said, well, let's pray. So we prayed before we went in. We opened that door. There's only one seat. That's going to be a problem, right? The one little swivel seat. And so we both just kind of inch on it, right? And we're looking at this chick, and this chick is looking at us like, who are you? She doesn't even know about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I looked at her and I said, I need to figure out, first of all, if I think she's alcoholic, right? Just because she's in prison or going to prison doesn't mean she's alcoholic. We do this quick little deal, right? We don't have much time. And the whatever the jailers are behind it are very confused because two people are not allowed in this little box, right? And they don't know who we are or what we are. And they just keep looking in there. Long story short, I looked at this girl and she goes, so who are you guys? And I said, we represent the program, you know, we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous. We've come down here to talk to you. I said, I'm going to tell you something, darling. You are a complete stranger. I am a complete stranger. All I can tell you is, for some reason out there in this big old world, you're getting a second chance. And I don't know why. I just got a phone call to come down here and talk to you. You're getting a second chance. That doesn't happen to people. I don't know what your journey in life is, man, but don't throw it away. And she is crying. I mean, this is a gang-banging chick. She is crying, and she goes, I'll take it. I'll take it. And I thought, oh, my God. We left out of there, and my sponsee goes, let me tell you something. I will carry you when you get out of here. I will be there for everything you need, and this little girl will be. And we leave out of there, and we are on such a high, and the judge comes in, and he says, you know, I didn't go. I go, done deal. It's really pretty cool. This is a big judge, criminal judge. 3 months later, we get a phone call. Same chick. Dude, out of here. She wants her 2 years in prison. This stuff stinks. She don't want to do the deal. Right? Come back down, Katie. I sat there and I looked at her and we start talking and I don't think she's one of us. I don't think she's one of us. I don't think she's one of us. She answered the questions in the beginning. But then she didn't answer the questions. I don't know if she is or if she isn't. And I looked at her and I said, okay, well, we'll be here for you. The doors of AA never shut. If you are or if you're not. But I'll go tell the judge that you want the 2 years in prison. So I went back out there and I went up and the judge called me up to the desk. I said, I don't think she's alcoholic. Of course, my sponsors are there going, you know, because I don't know. But she's given up the deal. And I'll tell you, the way she touched us was unbelievable. And that's all I can tell you. Is my life, if she stays sober, if she doesn't, if she gets it, if she goes, whatever. That was one of the most remarkable days in my life. I just want to tell you guys, thank you so much for having us. And we're done.